Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So today's talk is on the Vatupama Sutta, subtitled of Stained in Pure Cloth. And in this sutta, and it fits nicely coming to the conclusion of this 26-27 class study, where the Buddha uses metaphor, as he often does, to describe a quality of mind, that mind is either stained by ignorance or it's pure. And through this short sutta, the Buddha is emphasizing the importance of a pure and well-focused Dhamma practice. Even during the Buddha's teaching career, and that certainly accelerated after he passed, but even during his teaching career, there were people that wanted to adapt, accommodate, and embellish his Dhamma, even within his own Sangha and even within his own family. Devadatta comes to mind. It was a Buddha's cousin who tried to kill the Buddha twice unsuccessfully, so that he could be the leader of that Sangha and change it to fit his own point of views. And of course, beginning with the Mahasanghikas and then the Theravadins, Buddhism has been a 2,600-year history of adaptation, accommodation, and embellishment. So again, going back to the sutta, you'll notice how the emphasis that the Buddha keeps placing again and again on keeping a Dhamma practice pure. The Vatupama Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya 7. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Buddha was at Savatthi in Jita's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery. He addressed those gathered. Friends, suppose an unskilled person dyed a dirty cloth. Whether the cloth was blue, yellow, red, or pink, it would take the dye poorly, and the color would be impure. So what the Buddha is implying is that in order for your Dhamma practice to bear fruit, you have to get to that point where you've cleared out all of your confirmation bias, all of your conditioned thinking. That doesn't mean to start the practice you have to do that. It means to culminate the practice you have to do that. Why would the color be impure? Because the cloth was not clean. Again, we can't expect to adapt, accommodate, and embellish the Buddha's Dhamma and achieve the same results as an awakened human being's Dhamma. Although that is a common compulsion of almost everyone I've ever taught. And I use the word compulsion not in a negative way. It's just it's what occurs to a mind rooted in ignorance. That's another way of saying grasping after and clinging to. And so most human beings have spent their entire lives creating fabricated fictitious scenarios for who and what they are and the world they live in. And it's very, very difficult, especially at first, to recognize and abandon those fabrications because internally we feel that that defines us. And if we let go of even a shred of that, we're losing ourselves. So, of course, it takes the protection and the safety of actually taking refuge in this. And the Buddha refers to this just a little bit later in the sutta. That's why I'm prefacing it. There's safety and protection in actually developing the Dhamma as intended, but there's danger as far as continuing ignorance. There's danger in not. So too, the Buddha continues, when the mind is defiled, stress and disappointment should be expected. In other words, if we don't do something to change the way we think, we got no right to complain about the quality of our life because we're not doing anything about it. Now, friends, suppose a skilled person dyed a clean and bright cloth. Whether the cloth was blue, yellow, red, or pink, it would take the dye as intended, and the color would be pure. So once we develop the Eightfold Path as intended and abandon all of our fabrications, we have now prepared our minds for human awakening, for fulfilling our potential as human beings, for being fully human. But we first have to get out the garbage. There's a saying in computer, used to be more common, back then when more people were programmed, was garbage in and garbage out, which meant that if you programmed garbage into a computer, you could only expect to get something not very useful out of it. The same applies to our minds. If we put garbage in, we're going to have a garbage life. We're going to be seeing, another word for garbage would be defiled things, things that we no longer want. It applies to greed, anger, and deluded thinking. We don't want those things. Yet we need a way to recognize and abandon, and we need a way to do it in a very gentle way. So the Dhamma is both a full frontal attack on ignorance, but it's engaged with in such a way that allows us as human beings to gently recognize and abandon all of our fabrications, one after another. Remember the sutta, I can't remember the name right now, Ending Fabrications Through Jhana. There's another one that says this, basically the same title, Ending Fabrications One After Another, and you could add through jhana. So most people don't have one meditation session, listen to a couple of brilliant talks from a brilliant teacher, and immediately awaken. It's work for most of us. But this is describing the work. It's a step-by-step, piece-by-piece development of abandoning ignorance and developing wisdom within the proper framework. And as a Dhamma teacher, I would say what the Buddha taught, you can't do it without the structure. Most people don't want structure. A mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is averse to structure because it cannot maintain itself in a tight structure. It's another aspect of saying wanting to crave for anything that arises, what a mind rooted in ignorance does. And the color would be pure. Why would the color be pure? Because the cloth was clean. So too, when the mind is not defiled, freedom from greed, aversion, and deluded thinking should be expected. When the mind is not defiled, we are free of these defilements. A calm and peaceful mind will prevail. That's how the Buddha describes awakening. So the clear direction is right here. The Buddha teaches that an awakened, fully mature human mind, he describes that quality of mind as calm or at peace. And right here in one sentence, he describes if you want to develop the culmination, the quality of mind of an awakened human being, you have to recognize and abandon greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. Of course, those are all three components of one thing, that last, deluded thinking. With no deluded thinking, there's no greed and aversion.
John.
Yes, sir.
In regards to the practice, the dirty cloth is you trying to accommodate it so it fits your life.
Yes.
Outside of the cushion and the sangha.
Yep.
And if you are deluded in thinking, you'll ultimately be disappointed with your practice because you yep. haven't fully committed
yep.
to the concept that it, from the littlest thing to the grandest thing, it's all the same.
It's all the same. Yep. From the smallest detail of human life to the most obvious, it's all the same. And it's all an aspect of dukkha depending on how we look at it. If we have wrong view, we're only going to create more confusion and stress and suffering based on greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. If we recognize and abandon that, what does that mean? What does life look like when we've abandoned greed, aversion, and deluded thinking? Well, think about the inner mindset that is necessary to engage in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. What's the one defining aspect that every human being that is stuck in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking has? We take life personally. And so the Buddha's Dhamma is about recognizing and abandoning any personal aspect of life. And that's where people start losing their minds because it feels like annihilation. What the end result of that is what the Buddha just taught in that one line. Abandoning greed, aversion, and deluded thinking and living with a calm and peaceful mind no matter what occurs. And as David was saying, and it does take that pure Dhamma practice. But what are we giving up in order to practice the Dhamma purely? We're giving up ignorance. We're not giving up anything of any value except we think there is because I thought of it. I think that the way that I present myself to the world, even deep down, I know that it's a load of BS. It's all that I know of myself. So I need you to recognize me as I want you to recognize me, not how I really am. And in a mind rooted in delusion, that self-referential view is lacking. There's something wrong. I need more. I need a better position. I need to I need to prove to the world, whatever it might be, whatever my obsession is, whether it's being the world's wealthiest business person or the world's greatest lover, the world's greatest golfer, the world's greatest meditation teacher, or the world's greatest baker. It's all the same thing, as David was saying. It's all delusion. It's all rooted in greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. So what happens to the world's greatest baker when they awaken? Well, if they really were the world's greatest baker, they would continue in that line of work. But it wouldn't matter to them. They would simply be living their life at the highest level that is possible for a human being to live without being concerned about that. Do you get my point? When we're free of the defilements, we are naturally more effective and, to use the word, successful in the world, but not in the way other people might see it. In other words, some people might be completely at peace with living under a bridge, or as the Buddha did, living out, removed from society, out in a hut in the world. If some people would see that as insane, or even as an escape. But the individual knows that their mind is calm and at peace. But that can also take place with somebody at the highest level of corporate office, because it's just a quality of mind that is transferable and translatable to any situation.
And it would always come with ease.
And it would always come with ease. Again, no matter what you're saying, if you're spending your days sitting on the bank of a river, or the head of Microsoft, or the head of the country for that matter, nothing can shake that inner poise by abandoning anything that does not support it. We'll continue. The Buddha continues. Friends, listen closely as I will teach you the defilements of the mind. Greed, ill will. This is a long list that every one of them can be resolved through greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. But here's the list the Buddha gives us. Just to be mindful of manifestations of ignorance, how it comes out in different categories, even though it's all the same thing. It's all manifestation of ignorance. Greed, ill will, anger, denigration, domineering, envy, jealousy, hypocrisy, fraud, obstinance, conceit, prejudice, arrogance, vanity, and negligence. When I think back on my life, I was guilty of many times of all of those defilements. Not so much anymore. Let's skip over some commentary. Friends, the wise Dhamma practitioner knows these qualities as defilements of the mind. In other words, even during the Buddhist time, the Buddha recognized people walking around like Gordon Gekko. Greed is good. And we feel that we need, and it was such an interesting movie, because what Michael Douglas was portraying is what we do. We think that greed is good because of what it potentially can give us. And so we ignore the fact of the distraction and the stress of greed because we think it's necessary. We think we need to set high goals for ourselves or we'll never get there. Well, there's some truth to that, and there's some distraction and pain in that too. What the Buddha teaches is that each and every moment, David mentioned it just a moment ago, no matter what you're looking for out of your life, you must be present for what's occurring and not take any of it personally. Knowing this, the wise Dharma practitioner abandons them, meaning the three defilements. When these defilements have been completely abandoned through developing the Eightfold Path, the wise Dhamma practitioner knows that these defilements have been abandoned. Again, we talk often here about being mindful of the experience of this. The Buddha teaches that type of mindfulness that's rooted in jhana meditation is a key to developing the Dhamma. We have to recognize that it's working. The wise Dhamma practitioner, having abandoned these defilements directly, develops unwavering confidence in me. Now we're talking about taking refuge in the Buddha, his Dhamma, and a well-focused Sangha. Excuse me. Let me go back that one line. Having abandoned these defilements directly, they develop unwavering confidence in me. They know the teacher as accomplished and fully enlightened. They know the teacher is endowed with clear vision and virtuous conduct, They know the teacher's knowledge is sublime and complete, and a complete understanding of reality and of fabricated realms. In other words, it's not just an understanding of what it means to be a human being. The Buddha and we also understand what it means to not be a human being and the pain and suffering that follows. A teacher of all, they know the teacher is incomparable among those who can be taught. Another nudge towards reminding us that this is not about salvation. Not everybody's going to be able to take to this, but some can. Those with a little, just a speck of dust in their eyes. The Buddha continues, the wise Dhamma practitioner, having abandoned these defilements directly, develops unwavering confidence in my Dhamma. It's through engaging in a pure Dhamma practice that we are expressing the intention to take true refuge. They know the Dhamma is well taught, realizable here and now. They know my Dhamma is accessible, knowable, and brings immediate results, encouraging all to come and see for themselves. The wise Dhamma practitioner, having abandoned these defilements directly, develops unwavering confidence in the Sangha. They note they know those of the teacher Sangha have entered the skillful, straight, proper, and true path. That is to say, this wise Dhamma practitioner knows the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. This well-focused Sangha is worthy of gifts, hospitality, and respect. This Sangha's gift to the world is incomparable. The wise Dhamma practitioner, having abandoned these defilements directly, even in part, knows they have developed unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. Even in part means that as we, and we talk about this all the time, it's one of the reasons why we go around the room, is so that we can talk about developing the Dhamma. Even in part, we are inspiring and encouraging each other in the effectiveness of the Buddha's Dhamma. They gain, and the Buddha's speaking directly to this. I mean, this is from 2,600 years ago, and he's, even now, he's talking of the importance of a well-focused Sangha. They gain enthusiasm for the goal, for the Dhamma. There is gladness with connection to the Dhamma. Gladdened, joy is born. Joyous in mind, their body grows tranquil. From a tranquil body, there is happiness. For the mind of one who is happy, concentration increases. So the Eightfold Path is a symbiotic path. Right view, right intention, etc., feeds jhana. And right meditation, jhana meditation, supports the rest of the Eightfold Path. Getting back to the idea that it's not just sitting, it's not just meditation, which is really what most people want and expect out of their so-called Buddhist practices, to go sit for a while or visualize for a while, and they're going to be good to go. Doesn't happen that way. Just as a stained and dirty cloth, because in that scenario, what I just described, you're not cleaning the cloth. You're just continuing to pile on. Just as a stained and dirty cloth is cleaned with pure water, just as gold is purified with the heat of a furnace, a wise Dhamma practitioner, established in wisdom, virtue, and concentration, that's reference to the Eightfold Path. And I gotta say it again. Established in wisdom, virtue, and concentration, eats the most delicate, delicious alms food. They will not lose their way. The wise Dhamma practitioner abides with a mind permeated with loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy, and with equanimity for the entire universe. Equanimity is not a grasping after plea or a prayer for the universe that it be different than it is. Assuming say how the Buddha said it, or how it might translate. And with equanimity for the entire universe, it simply means you're at peace with everything, doesn't it? And it means nothing else. It doesn't imply anything. I did not have to recreate the universe in order to develop a mind resting in equanimity. I simply had to not take it personally. The key to the Buddha's Dhamma. Free of entanglements. Their mind boundless and free of hostility. I'm sorry. Hostility and ill will. A little bit loose dentures this morning. The wise Dhamma practitioner understands the three marks of existence and the path of liberation. just going to skip over this. When the wise Dhamma practitioner understands in this way, their mind is liberated from the fetter of sensual desire and of becoming. They are liberated from ignorance. Liberated, there is the knowledge, I am liberated. Giving birth to ignorance has ended. The pure life has been lived. The task is complete. I have overcome the world. This wise Dhamma practitioner is known as one who has bathed their inner being. I love that line. Let me just say it again. This Dhamma practitioner is one who is known as having bathed their inner being, cleaning out all the junk of ignorance. At this time, the Brahmin Sundarika was seated near the Buddha and asked, "Does Master Gautama bathe in the in the Bahuka River?" The Buddha responds, "What is the Bahuka River? What can the Bahuka River do? How could a river be anything other than a river? Master, it is true that many people believe that the Bahuka River can purify and bestow merit." The idea of baptism, isn't it? "Many people use the river to wash away their evil deeds just by ritual. Don't change anything. Just take a dip in the river and you're good to go. The number of people clinging to practicing and professing fabricated beliefs does not," these are my comments, "does not legitimize their beliefs." The Buddha responds, "Whether the Bahuka, the Andi," trying to read some writing, "the Andikaka, the Gaya, the Sudarika, the Payaga, the Sarasati, the fool bathes in many rivers, but will never find purification for their unskillful deeds." What power do these rivers possess? And this is, the river is both metaphor for any type of ritual or visualization or prayer we might offer hoping to reach salvation. What power does the river possess? They can never purify the evildoer. Those who have purified themselves should be celebrated. They do much good for the world. Always wise, virtuous, and well concentrated, it is here that you should bathe. If you wish to be a true refuge for all beings, it is here that you should bathe. Brahman Sundarika, if you teach false dharmas and harm other beings, interesting to making that connection in one sentence, teaching false dharmas, harming other beings, and take what is not offered you, and that's an aspect of teaching false dharmas in any way, because that's taking what is not freely given, which is people giving you their time hoping to find liberation when all you're teaching is more bondage. Is not offered you. Following your belief, what could a river do for you? Any well contains water. In other words, how could one river, or that we're hoping that it's the water in a river that's going to somehow change me or save me? It's just water. So why not just jump in a well? Or a bathtub, for that matter. Again, the Buddha continues, how could a river be anything other than a river? Hearing the great teacher's words, Brahman Sundarika declared, "Magnificent Master Gautama, you have made your Dhamma clear in many ways. You have righted what was overturned. You have shown what was hidden. You have shown the way to one who is lost. You are holding a lamp in the darkness for those with eyes to see. I take refuge in Master Gautama, in your Dhamma, and in your Sangha. Please bestow the going forth to develop your path." The going forth simply means the Buddha's accepting them into the Sangha. The Brahman Sundarika received the going forth and quickly realized for himself the culmination of the path. He understood birth has ended, the well-integrated life, usually translated as the holy life, the well-integrated life has been lived. There is nothing more for this world. Sundarika was now an arahant, a fully awakened human being. That's today's talk. Thank you. We'll go online. Start with Mary. Mary, how are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking.
So this one is more like, you know, this is definitely holding yourself accountable. This one isn't easy, right? Some of them are, some of the messaging is easier to digest, perhaps. And this one is about holding ourselves accountable, even in, you know, I imagine even in our lives today, living in the world that we're living in. It's a message about remaining true to the Eightfold Path.
Yep.
And the Four Noble Truths, and not getting distracted by these other things in our lives, in our community, in our culture, and using those reactions to those things to justify a feeling, a thought, a frustration. You know, I'm sure you can accelerate those words. So it's really a reminder that it does come back to holding yourself accountable to right view, but also right intention, right speech, you know, right effort, right concentration. Really, I mean, as with all of them, they come full circle. But I just heard this one that way, that it's a bit of, I don't think it's meant as admonishing, but it's a bit like, hey, check yourselves. And make sure that you're not getting distracted, and make sure that you maintain your commitment to, maybe that's not exactly the right way to say it, but make sure you can remain focused, you know, keep the concentration to the fore of focusing on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So, like, this was a bit like schooling or something. Very useful, of course. So thank you, John.
Thank you, Mary, for your analysis. And that, you know, those are the right words. Holding ourselves accountable. That's what the Buddha's Dhamma is all about. In fact, it was the thing that was most appealing to me when I realized what the Buddha was actually teaching. It's up to me. And there's, I mean, that to me, that's all the power in the world, is to finally realize that my experience of my life is up to me. As the Buddha describes dukkha, birth, sickness, aging, and death, not getting what I want, getting what I don't want. That's part of having a human life. And when I don't take those things personally, including the five clinging aggregates, I'm free. I didn't, you know, when I was born, I didn't really know, nobody knows, I don't think, what life is supposed to be all about and where I was going and what was most important. But I knew that I was confused about that. And it wasn't until I actually developed an understanding of Four Noble Truths that I understood my confusion and my purpose in life. And my purpose in life is very, very simple: to have a calm and peaceful mind. And when I think about that, and, you know, to some people say, well, isn't there more to life than that? That's the one thing that we're all trying to do. But we're doing it in ways that can't possibly be successful. Some people think that they can maintain a calm and peaceful mind by getting the biggest pile of gold. Some people think that it's by getting the right spouse. Again, we go through that whole list of things that we decide we must have, and then we can have a calm and peaceful mind. It reflects on something Mary just said. Many people have lost their Dhamma practice during this period because it's so distracting that we can't even think of Dhamma practice because we're so entangled in the world again. We can't get back to simply sitting and being at peace. That calm and peaceful mind seems almost selfish in a world that's going crazy, hasn't it? But it's not. It's the most sane thing we can do for everyone. And you hear me say it over and over again, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for every other human being on this planet is to take to the Dhamma and awaken, so at the very least I won't be contributing to the stress and suffering in the world. You know? Josh, how are you today? Good morning.
Well,
there you are.
Hi, everybody. Hi, John.
Good to see you.
Well, I can just kind of echo what Mary said. And I have to admit, I have a little bit of tension within myself because the Buddha really kind of left us no exit. if we want to be responsible human beings, he pretty well lays it out.
Yeah.
And I want to take detours all the time from finding full realization. And I'm not sure why, but I think my conditioned mind is so powerful that I have to really work and trying to kind of work around it. And
that's clinging, Josh.
Sometimes I'm successful, but most of the time I'm not. Yeah. Thanks, John.
Yeah, thank you, Josh. And it's just that way, you know. But your conditioned mind is not powerful. It seems that way, though. You know, but it's not. As the Buddha describes it, it's like foam on the ocean. Once you recognize what's there, you'll see no substance. But that's just continued Dhamma practice. So thanks for joining this morning. Rob, how are you? There you are.
Oh, good. I don't really have anything to add this morning.
Really? Well, I'm glad you joined us. David, how are you?
Yes, David. Good job. Thank you for your teaching. You mentioned something about people want to sit and find ease, but really what you're doing is you're working to understand. It's not an idle, pleasant time. You're putting work in.
That's right.
You're looking at what you're clinging to in those really subtle things that arise, and the concentration that you're gathering and gaining is letting you recognize that, so you can release from it. So to me, I've never sat for relaxation or finding ease. I've only sat to try to understand.
Yeah.
So it's not something that the hardest point. Why would you stop trying to understand? And that's why during any time period, whether it's war or disease or COVID or unrest or I'm just tired, it's all the same to me, and I'm trying to understand. So thank you.
Wow. Thank you, David. That's the point in meditation. It is work, but it's gentle work. But it should be looked at as, this is, if I want to awaken, which I do, this is the work I must do. You know, the work doesn't have to be drudgery, does it? When you look at it, it's the most freeing thing we can do, but it still has to be done. And it still has to be done in a practical way. You know, when you're putting a roof on, you got to know where to put your nails or the roof is no good. The same thing with jhana meditation. You know what you need to focus on, your breath and nothing else. Not feeling good, not an escape. Just to recognize that time on your cushion is supporting the rest of your entire Eightfold Path. Thank you, David. Good morning, Brett.
Good morning. Good to be here. I don't really have much to say, but not taking it personally, and it's good to hear that. And I guess not in conjunction with the aggregates, so not taking the aggregates personally, I guess, when they arise, or as you're saying. And so I think that's a helpful thing to hear, and keep on coming.
I'm glad. What Brett just mentioned, the five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness, ongoing thinking, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. When you look at those five elements or qualities, that's what we cling to maintain ignorance. And that is what we're learning to take impersonally, form, feeling, perception. Just because I'm thinking something does not mean that it's true, despite what many people say. Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
Good morning, John. This is a great teaching. It's very concrete, and it's very demanding, too. Like Mary said, it's not just simple. It's not as simple as just taking a dip in a river and saying, okay, now I'm cool. But I think this whole cycle that you've done, 25 so far teachings, it's interesting how it's coincided with the pandemic and civil unrest and things like this, and things that in my lifetime have been, you know, seeming way worse than other stuff, you know, but it has helped me from not losing my mind over it and to staying centered, and to, when I see for myself through each meditation session, that it is worth it and it is achievable, then it's there, and the teachings really help. Thank you,
Kevin. really right from, I remember when you came in and joined us in Clinton, I guess it was. And I remember what you were bringing back to class, and almost from the beginning, you were recognizing the benefits of what you were doing. Is that true?
Yes, that's true.
And that that gave you the encouragement you needed to continue, more so than anything else.
Yes.
Yeah, and that again, that's how the Buddha taught the Dhamma. It almost immediately we can experience its effectiveness, and we should be mindful of that, and that's what feeds our practice. So, thank you. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning. To everybody's point, people do have this assumption that meditation is to relax and to calm down. And really, it is for that understanding. And I'd like to add, if I could, to David's point, reconciliation, because it took a while for me to reconcile that everything that arises passes away. Mm-hmm. And to that point of the anicca, of impermanence.
Yeah.
And to recognize that, to reconcile that, to understand that, aids in that tranquility, that understanding, that reconciliation of just that. That's a universal truth.
Yeah.
And that helps it to suit this point of purity. That's a wholesome desire to get to.
Yeah.
You know, and during these times, with the storm, with the pandemic, there's two ways of approaching it. There's diving in doom and despair, or understanding these things and looking at this as an opportunity of understanding and reconciliation.
Wow. Yes. Well put, Tim. And that is the awakened, everybody's throwing around that word woke. It seems like those that describe themselves that way aren't, but it would make sense, wouldn't it, that an awakened human being would be just as you described. You know, we're no longer reacting to things. They don't need to be any different than they are, even though they're horrible. I mean, this is, you know, it's a very difficult 6 months or a year for planet Earth, but so, you know, we maintain a calm and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring, and we do what we can. You know, it's something else that has changed. I don't want to get into another political talk, but hopefully if something good comes out of it, and I'm not sure if it will, but will be people reaching out to each other again. I've heard a lot of stories of neighbors checking on neighbors that we kind of gotten away to. We used to do when I was growing up in my neighborhood, you know, if somebody 10 houses down got sick, half the neighborhood went down there with a bowl of soup. I mean, that's just the way we lived. And we don't seem to do that anymore. And I think it's because there's such a push that the government should bring us a bowl of soup when we want it, rather than our neighbors. And that's a complete disconnect from reality, isn't it? You know, and that's really, again, I don't want to make another, I keep saying that, but I did want to say that, or I wouldn't have said it. So that's what I want to say. So the Dhamma brings us to a practical way of looking at the world and true compassion married with wisdom. You know, it is true compassion. You notice your neighbor needs a bowl of soup, you bring them a bowl of soup. You know, and if they just need a chat, you chat with them, even though you might be afraid of getting the virus. You know, I remember when the AIDS thing blew up and I started hearing about, I mean, it was awful how we treated AIDS patients in the beginning. I used to go in New York. I actually got a minister's license for $25 so that I had a credential to walk into a hospital, because they were so isolated that they didn't even get, they would get, AIDS patients then would get sick and they basically quarantine them without getting any human contact. And I still remember walking into it. And I can see these people walking into a room with nurses kind of screaming at me, don't go in there. And just the relief of sitting across from someone that person felt, just that a human being was talking to them. It was worth, and I didn't think that I was, just to qualify a little, back then it was kind of like today. They everybody was putting out that you could get AIDS by sitting on a toilet seat, you know. And that lasted for quite a few years, that kind of hysteria. And it was just such an incredibly important point, not point, experience for me to understand. I started to understand what real compassion was at that point. I didn't understand it at all. That you can't have any compassion without the ability to be present with someone. You know, you could be sitting in the same room. We know that all the time. We talk to people and they just don't seem to be here. We see it on TV all the time too. The key to the Dhamma is to be present with your life as your life unfolds, and the key to interpersonal relationships is to be present with other people as our lives unfolds. And in that way, we can actually give people a bowl of soup when they need it, but we can start engendering peace through mindful communication rather than demands that things be different than they are. You know, we can start listening to people again. I hope we do. Sorry for the speech this morning. I got to get going. I got a ride coming. We'll conclude this series on Tuesday with a section from the Dhammapada, the last chapter, called the Brahmanavaga, which is appropriate for concluding this. And then next Saturday, we're going to begin our study, 26-class study of the Dhammapada itself. And I've been looking forward to that for a year, so I hope you enjoy it as well. We'll finish, as we always do, with meditation. So gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Thank you for joining online. See you guys soon.
Thank you, John. Have a good week.
You too.
Thanks. Bye.
See you, Josh.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.